14. He closed his eyes and willed. He imagined the room. He pictured Gretchen, the coffee table, the package of cigarettes, the lighter beside it. He pictured the ashtray, the drapes, the couch and phonograph. When he opened his eyes, the room was back, but Gretchen was gone. He was alone in the house. The shades were all down, and he had a deep intuition of lateness, as if, he thought, time had passed. A clock on the mantel read 8:30. Had 4 whole hours gone by? 4 hours. Gretchen? He said experimentally. He went to the stairs and started up. Still no sign of her. The house was warm, the air pleasant and fresh. Somewhere an automatic heating unit functioned. A room to his right was her bedroom. He glanced in. The small ivory clock on the dressing table did not read 8:30. It read 4:45. Gretchen had overlooked it. She had not set it forward with the one downstairs. Instantly he was running back downstairs, 2 steps at a time. The voices had reached him as he lay on the couch. Kneeling, he pressed his hands over the fabric, across the arms and back, under the cushions. Finally, he dragged the couch away from the wall. The first speaker was mounted within a coil of backspring. A second and then a third were concealed under the rug. They were as flat as paper. He estimated that at least 12 speakers had been mounted throughout the room. Since Gretchen had been upstairs, the control unit was undoubtedly there. Again he climbed the stairs and entered her bedroom. At first he failed to recognize it. The control lay in plain sight on the woman's dressing table, with the jars and tubes and packages of cosmetics, the hairbrush. He picked it up and rotated the plastic handle. From downstairs boomed a man's voice.
"There remains some island of ego."
Gretchen's voice answered.
"But submerged."
"Totally withdrawn," Malparto continued. "The shock..."
The tape transport, mounted somewhere in the walls of the house, had halted in the middle of its cycle. Downstairs again, he searched for the means by which Gretchen had dissolved the house. When he found it, he was chagrined. The unit was built into the fireplace, in open view, one of the many comfort-making gadgets. He pressed the stud, and the room around him with its furnishings and rich textures seeped away. The outside world remained. Houses, the street, the sky, a glimmer of stars. The device was a mere romantic gadget. For long, dull evenings, Gretchen was an active girl. In a closet under a heap of blankets, he found a newspaper used as a shelf liner. It was empirical proof. The newspaper was the Vega Sentinel. He was not in a fantasy world. He was on the 4th planet of the Vega system. He was on the other world, the permanent refuge maintained by the mental health resort. Maintained for persons who had come, not for therapy, but for sanctuary. Finding the phone, he dialed 0.
"Number, please,"
the operator said, the faint, tinny, and terribly reassuring voice. "Give me one of the spaceports," he said, "anyone that has intersystem service." A series of clicks, buzzes, and then he was connected with the ticket office. A methodical male voice on the other end of the wire said, "Yes, sir. What can I do for you?" "What's the fare to Earth?" He wondered in a stricken way just how long he had been here. A week? A month? "One way, first class, $930, plus 20% luxury tax." The voice was without emotion. He had no such money. "Now what's the next system in order?" "Sirius." "How much is that?" He didn't have over $50 in his wallet, and this planet was under the jurisdiction of the health resort. It had acquired it with its deed. "One way, first class, tax included, comes to $742. He calculated. "What's it cost to phone Earth?" The ticket agent said, "You'll have to ask the phone company, mister. That's not our business." When he had gotten the operator again, Alan said, "I'd like to place a call to Earth."
"Yes, sir."
She did not seem surprised.
"What number, sir?"
He gave Telemedia's number, and then the number on the phone he was using. It was as simple as that. After several minutes of buzzing, the operator said,
I'm sorry, sir. Your party does not answer.
What time is it there?
A moment, and then, in that time zone, it is 3 a.m., sir.
In a husky voice, he said, Look, I've been kidnapped. I have to get out of here, back to Earth.
I suggest you call one of the inter-system transport fields, sir, the operator said.
All I've got is $50!
I'm sorry, sir. I can connect you with one of the fields if you wish.
He hung up. There was no point staying in the house, but he lingered long enough to type out a note with a vengeance. He left the note in the middle of the coffee table, where Gretchen would be sure to see it. Dear Mrs. Coates, you remember Molly? Damned if I didn't run into her at the Brass Poker. Says she's pregnant, but you know how that kind are. Think I better stay with her until we can get her a you-know-what. Expensive, but it's the price you pay. He signed it Johnny and then left the house. Otherworld had plenty of roving taxis, and within 5 minutes he was in the downtown business district with its lights and flow of people. At the spaceport, a full-size ship stood upright on its tail. He guessed, with almost frenzied despair, that it was in the process of leaving for the next system. A line of supply trucks dashed back and forth. The ship was already in the final stages of loading. Paying off the taxi, he tramped across the gravel parking lot of the field, down the street, until he arrived at a Syndrome of Life, a restaurant doing an active business, full of patrons and noise and chatter. Feeling like a fool, he buttoned his coat up around him and strode through the doorway to the cashier. Put up your hands, lady, he said, jutting out his pocket, before I put a McAllister heat beam through your head. The girl gasped, raised her hands, opened her mouth, and gave a terrified bleat. Patrons at nearby tables glanced up in disbelief. Okay, Alan said in a normally loud voice. Now let's have the money. Push it across the counter before I blow out your brains with my McAllister heat beam.
Oh, dear, the girl said.
From behind him, two Otherworld police wearing helmets and crisp blue uniforms appeared and grabbed his arms. The girl flopped out of sight, and Alan's hand was yanked from his pocket.
A noose, one cop said. A super noose. It's troublemakers like this ruin a clean neighborhood.
Let go of me, Alan said, before I blow off your heads with my McAllister heat beam.
Buddy,
one of the cops said as they dragged him from the restaurant.
This cancels the resort's obligations to succor you. You've shown your unreliability by committing a felony.
I'll blow all of you to bits, Alan said as they bundled him into the police car.
This heat beam talks. Get his ident.
A cop snatched Alan's wallet.
John B. Coates, 2319 Pepper Lane. Well, Mr. Coates, you've had your chance. Now you're on your way back to Morrick. How does that sound?
You won't live to send me back, Alan said. The car was sprinting toward the field, and the big ship was still there.
I'll get you! You'll see!
The car, flying a foot above the gravel, turned into the field and made directly for the ship. The siren came on. Field attendants stopped work and watched.
Tell him to hold it, one of the cops said.
He got out a microphone and contacted the field's tower.
Another super noose. Open up the Fleeby.
In a matter of seconds, the car had come alongside the ship. The doors had united, and Alan was in the hands of the ship's sheriff.
Welcome back to Morrick,
a run-down fellow super noose muttered, as Alan was deposited beside him in the restricted area.
Thanks, Alan said with relief. It's good to be back.
Now he was wondering if he would reach Earth by Sunday. On Monday morning, his job at Telemedia started. Had he lost too much time?
Whoosh, the floor went.
The ship was rising.